Good morning.
Morning.
I'm going to start today with a question. How are you all doing with your New Year's resolutions? And I have my answer. I know I'm a bit late with this question. The New Year's resolution sermon's normally at the start of January, but it's my first sermon this year, so it's my first chance to ask you. And actually, I'm asking today because it's a better time to ask you. If I'd been doing the first sermon this year, we'd only been 5 days into the year, and that's too early. If you're already failing then, there was no point in making it in the first place, was there? But it's nearly a month now. Even the most determined of people can be struggling at this point. Have you managed to get this far into the year without any sugar? Or have you been to the gym 3 times every week? Now, this week we had what they call now Blue Monday. It usually happens on the third Monday in January, and it gets called the most depressing day of the year. Apparently, and it hasn't really, but apparently it's been worked out with a scientific formula, but it's nonsense. But the reasons they put into this so-called formula include, well, Christmas is a few weeks behind you, so the joy of that's worn off. It's the middle of winter, so it's cold and dark. You've just had your credit card bill for all the money you spent in December on Christmas. Not me, by the way, because my credit card bill comes on the 25th of every month, which means in this automated age of internet banking, I get a credit card bill on Christmas Day every year. What a lovely gift from my bank. And one final reason for Blue Monday is you're now feeling guilty because everyone's already given up on their New Year's resolutions. In reality, it's a load of nonsense made up by a travel company who then paid a lecturer to put his name to it. And the formula, they just wrote some letters down for a formula. And we did it to try and take advantage of this general truth that people are a bit more unlikely to be unhappy in the winter, especially after Christmas, and try and get them then to book summer holidays, because they're dreaming then of a holiday in the sun. It's more enticing when you feel cold and miserable. So while it's nonsense that this idea of this single most depressing day of the year, all those reasons can kind of add up to make January a bit more of a depressing month than usual for most people. Winter nights that seem lovely and cosy in the run-up to Christmas now just seem cold, dark and miserable. And so it's actually the worst time of year to make the kind of resolutions people make at New Year. If you're already miserable, why would you want to add giving up cake on top of that? And so, while some of these reasons these resolutions often fail is because January is a bad time of year, another reason it fails is just time to give to these resolutions. I mean, going to the gym 3 times a week sounds great until you have to actually find the time to do it. The busyness of life leaves you so tired you just don't even feel like going. You just want to slump in a chair. It wasn't supposed to be like that anymore. Like 50 years ago, when they were kind of predicting the future, they predicted this technological age where we'd only have to work like 3 or 4 hours a week because robots would be doing everything for us. We'd have all this free time, and what would we know how to do with it? And it's just not happened like that. I mean, some technologies help, like washing machines have generally made people's lives easier. But other machines have taken that time back and more, like the internet with social media and cat videos on YouTube. Because the modern age has actually brought us so much choice, and we struggle with it. The internet and faster, cheaper travel have brought a variety of cultures, which has its advantages. But not that long ago in British culture, the question, what do you want for dinner, meant which meat do you want with which 2 veg? Now it means there's an almost infinite number of options from all over the world. Advertising is one of the big changes in the modern age. We now have so much choice that people need to put in the time to sell their particular option. And advertising has changed what people think they need to be happy. Before advertising, most people were happy if their essential needs were met. These days, people are unhappy if their phone is no longer the latest model. This is how modern advertising works, though. Most of it is designed to make you feel unhappy with what you have, so you need to buy more. It doesn't want to offer you something and say, this is nice, maybe you'd like it. It says, you need this. Your life will be miserable without this. You literally cannot live without this thing that you've somehow managed to live without until now. And it's a common advertising strategy to make people feel like without this new product, you're missing out. We have the similar thing now with the January sales this month. The shops don't say, we're selling off this stuff that we couldn't sell at full price. So we're just making it cheap to try and get rid of it. Oh, it's grab these bargains while you can or you will have missed out. You buy something on eBay, it tells you, you have won. No, you've spent money. If you don't spend the money now, you miss out on this once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. Until the next sale next week. If you don't spend the money now and get it while it's cheap, you'll have nothing apart from the money that you save by not spending it. I walked past a bookshop window recently, and they had this display of books all in this series. They're all 1001 somethings you must something before you die. A nice cheery title. And one of them was 1001 books you must read before you die. Though I doubt that book is one of the 1001 books. And I'm certainly not planning to bother with it. But there were plenty of others in that series. You don't just have 1001 books that you must read before you die. There's more to be done. Apparently, there are 1001, and it always happens to be 1001. Strange coincidence, that. All these things that you must experience, because there are 1001 albums you must hear, movies you must see, buildings you must see, paintings you must see, and also beers you must try, wines you must try, and whiskies you must try. You have to be careful with the last three, though, because they have the potential to shorten the time you have to fit everything else in. There's so much relaxing to be done and just not enough time to do it. And I haven't even considered all the sport that is to be watched. So where am I meant to fit in my New Year's resolutions? See, these books could have been called 1001 books you might enjoy reading, or 1001 albums that are quite nice to listen to. But no, you must do these things before you die. Read this, watch that, drink that, relax. You must, or you will have failed. You can now fail at watching movies or drinking wine. No wonder the world's so exhausted. Even relaxing now comes with to-do lists to work through. It's become a badge of honour in British society now that when someone asks you how you're doing, you tell them how busy you are. If Monty Python were writing the Four Yorkshiremen sketch today, they'd all be arguing about who was the busiest working 200 hours plus a week. So you could read all 1001 books, watch all 1001 movies, and listen to all 1001 albums. And while you might get pleasure from them, you're not going to suddenly feel, oh, I'm so satisfied now, I'm ready to die happy. Perhaps the 1001 beers, wines, and whiskies would bring some temporary satisfaction, but in the long term, they're more likely to bring you liver disease than true satisfaction. And people trying to convince us that they can sell us this better life has made people more hungry for this wonderful, perfect life they see in magazines and Instagram pictures. And they make our expectations so big that they cannot be met. And it's this gap, I think, between our expectations and reality that's led to the emotional unhealthiness that the EHS course we've been doing is trying to correct. Over the last 4 months, across these different sessions, we've seen that emotional health is not about whether we have the right things, but whether we're doing the right things, particularly whether we're slowing down and connecting with God. And a big part of the course, and how we're going to continue beyond the course, most importantly, is this final session where we meet. It's called the Rule of Life. It doesn't always get the best reaction when you say that, though, Rule of Life. No one likes rules. The word rule here doesn't actually mean what you usually think of when you hear the word rule. The word rule comes from the Greek word for trellis. So it means like a frame that supports plants and allows them to go upwards in the right direction and grow strong. And so the term rule of life, and it was first used in the church, which was around the year 300, it was not about creating rules to follow, kind of creating a framework to help Christians best follow Jesus, to help them grow up strong in Christ. And the rule of life, it started in monasteries, and something now actually becoming more popular with Christians today as they look back to Christians from centuries gone by and try to follow these ancient paths. And still, though, as soon as people hear the word rule, they can easily be put off. And although that's not the meaning of the word here, it still has that effect on people. So good communication doesn't just consider what you might mean by a word when you say it, also has to consider what the listener might be hearing when they hear that word. And when people hear the word rule, they have a negative reaction. Words matter. In Romeo and Juliet, Shakespeare wrote, "What's in a name? That which we call a rose, by any other name would smell as sweet." And many people just repeat that as truth. But not everyone. Not the Montreal Neurological Institute, because they decided to test this. And so they asked people what they thought of 15 different smells, and they gave names to them, some positive, some negative, some neutral, but they switched the names around. So to see how would the smell be judged with a different name, and the names had an effect on how people rated the smells. Really nice, fancy perfumes were rated lower when they were called moldy vegetables, and they genuinely used that name. And so it seems a rose called moldy vegetables does not smell as sweet. The point is, words matter. And I can explain to you that the term rule of life doesn't mean rules, but all you're going to hear is the word rules and the connotation the word brings. And as leaders, we all felt the same about it. None of us were happy about it. And we talked about it for a while and came up with all sorts of alternatives. And for a while, at least we agreed all of them were better than rule of life. But in the end, we narrowed it down to one, and we're going to call it the way of life. And so now we've decided on that name, way of life, rather than a rule. We need to think about what it is. And so returning to the idea of a trellis, it's something that you put in place to help yourself grow. It's that framework of what you are going to do to become the person you want to be. It will usually include things like you want to do daily, some weekly and monthly, others maybe annually or seasonally. For example, people will often put down, say, reading the Bible as a daily thing, but maybe something like going on a retreat as an annual activity. Hopefully none of you are considering now putting reading the Bible down as an annual activity. Though who knows, for some of you maybe that's an improvement, I don't know. Nearly 3 years ago, I gave a sermon about habits. And one of the things I mentioned is that how many things we do every day that are just done without thinking, these habits that are learned behaviours. And it's a really good thing because it allows us to do things with minimal brain power and conserve energy. And that could be a great advantage to us, that we can just do so many things with such little thought. Arrive at work without even thinking about how we got there. But there is a downside that we can so easily fall into bad habits and routines. And so with these habits, for better or worse, you already have a way of life. You probably never wrote it down, but you have routines that you put in place. Some probably very deliberately, others maybe not so much. See, I doubt I'm the only person here who could talk you through their morning routine between getting up and leaving the house, exactly in the same order you do it every day. Over and over, every weekday morning. And I'm not going to talk you through it because it's incredibly boring and you don't care whether I brush my teeth before or after I shave. That's really kind of part of my way of life, just the way I do things. As I said about 10 minutes ago, this way of life, as I wasn't calling it back then, it's an important step in how we approach life. The most famous of these ways of life, is the way of St. Benedict. Well, really, it's the rule of St. Benedict. And he lived about 1,500 years ago, and he was very unhappy with what he saw as the immorality of people in the Roman Empire. And so he decided he was going to become a monk, and he wrote this rule of how he thought he and his fellow monks should live. I want to be clear that I'm not suggesting we follow his rule of life, particularly as it has 73 chapters. We're not about to start a monastery either. We're talking about something much more simpler than that, just about looking at certain aspects of our lives and thinking about how we might alter them to make room for God. So I just want to look at a few areas where we might do this. The first is the Bible, which reminds me that I haven't looked at any Bible passages yet, and this is a sermon. This is not ideal. Sam would be in double figures already. So I could look at some Bible passages that say we should read the Bible, but it kind of feels like circular logic to me. So instead, I want to read what Jesus said to the Jewish leaders about the Bible in John 5, 39 and 40. You study the scriptures diligently because you think that in them you have eternal life. These are the very scriptures that testify about me, yet you refuse to come to me to have life. See, I didn't suggest the Bible as the first item you might consider for your rule of life because it's nice to know the Bible better, although it is. I suggested it because it's vital to know your Bible to know Jesus better. And that means being serious about spending time with the Bible. I mean, saying we should read the Bible shouldn't really be controversial in a church. But how easy can it be to just become too busy? But if following Jesus is important to us, then the Bible needs to be important to us. That requires deliberately making time for it. As a teacher, part of my job is helping students create smart targets for themselves. In case you don't know that or you've forgotten, SMART is an acronym for specific, measurable, achievable, realistic, and time-bound. And a SMART target's got to fit all those words. You may have had to do them like job appraisals stuff and do them every year. What's your SMART target for the next year? What are you going to aim for? And you want to say, I'm just going to keep doing my job like everyone else. But my students have to do this now every half term in every subject. And it's no good them just saying, I'm going to work harder. It's not acceptable. It's got to be something like, I will complete every homework on time this term. It's specific. You can measure whether you've done it. It's achievable. It's realistic. At least for some of my students, it is. And it's time-bound. It means it's not open-ended. There's like a fixed time when you can see whether it's done or not. And I'm not saying we have to be that strict with things we put in our way of life. But we need to be more specific about, I will read my Bible more. Or if that's your New Year's resolution, it never really happens, does it? So we need to maybe be thinking a bit more about, well, when will I do it? When will I make time? And that can seem to be the difficult part, especially when your days feel busy enough already. But as busy as you may be, if you're a follower of Jesus, there's got to be something you do every day that is less important than reading the Bible. Some area where you could say, if I just stop doing that, I could use the time to read the Bible instead. And reading, by the way, is not the only way you can engage with the Bible. I listen to the Bible every morning using the Bible app while I'm shaving and brushing my teeth. Though not necessarily in that order. You're intrigued now, aren't you? You want to know which you do first. You didn't think that was what you're going to come away from today thinking about, did you? I'm not telling you. I do read the Bible as well as listen to it, just like to point out. But for me, that's just a way of making use of good use of time where you're kind of stuck doing boring but necessary tasks. So you could try that. It could work for you. Another area of the way of life I want to look at is the daily office. Now, we've been doing this, all those who've been part of the EHS course, because it was such a big part of the lives of the monks and the original rule of life. This idea of at least twice a day, you just stop. It includes times of silence, times of just reflecting on God, times of devotional study. So you could go through that book again and again and again if you wanted. I mean, parts of it are so deep, they demand repeated reading. But the daily office doesn't have to mean reading through Pete Scazzaro's book over and over. It's really about taking that time at least twice a day to just stop everything and be with God. You could take that 2 minute silence and devote it with any kind of devotional study. Every day with Jesus or Word for Today or whatever you might want to use. Or just with reading the Bible or a time of prayer. Or it can even just be that time of silence. I've found this very useful working in a college where it's a fast moving day and you go on one lesson to the other. Just when you've just had one lesson with a bunch of difficult students, And you've got another one coming up. Just 2 minutes of silence with God, focusing on what's important, can just make such a difference to your attitude and your outlook. And it could make a difference in your stressful situations too. And while that 2 minutes of silence from the daily office is great, another thing you might want to consider is taking longer periods of silence and solitude. This may be something you just do once a month, once a year, maybe some kind of retreat. It may just be taking an hour away from things and being silent with God. But we need to be able to find ways to take ourselves out of the day-to-day busyness of life and devote time to God. And another way of doing that is the weekly time of Sabbath. I'm not going to go over the concept of Sabbath again because we've already covered it in a previous session. But it's something we're going to need to look at taking on from this course. And if we're going to do that, it needs to be part of our way of life. And the Sabbath can also be a good way of helping with another area you may want to consider with your way of life, your family. The most important thing you can ever know about God is just these three simple words: God is love. Those three words don't just describe something about God, but everything he is. Everything else about God is just a smaller part of that description. God is love. And this is modelled, first of all, in the Trinity. If God was just on his own at the start, before creation, he couldn't have been love, because love requires an object to love. But before there was anything else, there was the Trinity as this perfect model of love. And that's something we need to copy in our families. So we're called to become like Christ, and ultimately that has to mean becoming more loving. So we need to practice that love with people, and that has to start with the people closest to us. Because these are the essential relationships where that act of loving these people can't be delegated to someone else. So maybe your way of life could include how you're going to give time and love to your family. If you're married, your spouse has only got one spouse. No one else is going to give them the love and support that they should be able to expect from you. If you're a parent, there is no substitute to your child than that love of a parent. In fact, if you are a parent, there is no more important responsibility in the world to you than being a loving parent. And I know these aren't shocking revelations of an amazing new truth. It's kind of obvious stuff, but it's the kind of stuff that in the hurry of life, it's so easy that these things fall behind the wayside. Them a family, they'll understand. But they shouldn't have to. And I know there's things like, you know, part of loving well is that you earn money to provide for those you love, so it can be difficult. I appreciate that. But this is why the Sabbath can be an even more important thing for families. A time when everything stops together for all of you. And it can include time alone as well. Because part of loving well is giving people space when they need it. I realise this may jar and be difficult for some of you who either aren't in families, or maybe your families aren't Christian and so aren't going to want to share Sabbath time with you. But remember that in this church we are one family. You can Sabbath with people you aren't related to by either blood or marriage. I listened to a sermon by a woman who was single, and she was just talking about, you know, how she approached Sabbath, because most of the preachers here talking about it, they're married with children. And so she meets the same friend every week for coffee on her Sabbath. And so there are new other ways of, you know, creating that time with wider family. Of course, you may be an introvert like me, and meeting up with other people might ruin your Sabbath, but I'm just saying, it's there, it's an option. Another area you might want to consider for your way in life is play and recreation. Let's look at a couple more Bible verses. In Ecclesiastes 3, 12 and 13, Solomon says, "I know that there is nothing better for people than to be happy and to do good while they live, that each of them may eat and drink and find satisfaction in their toil. This is the gift of God." 1 Corinthians 10:31 says, "So whether you eat or drink or whatever you do, do it all for the glory of God." We can glorify God by eating and drinking and just having fun. God delights in us And so when we're having fun and being joyful, that brings God joy. This is one of his gifts to us. And it may seem wrong that, for me to be saying this, though, put it in a way of life as though you have to plan or schedule fun. And it can be really hard to schedule recreation these days when TV has the football all over the place. But your way of life, it's not about scheduling. It's not about saying, like, every day, 6:30, read the Bible, 7 o'clock, eat some food, 7:30, play tiddlywinks. It's not that, but it's about being intentional about what is important. Because we can too easily just kind of, oh, let things happen and be full of regrets over what we didn't do that we wished we had done. So be intentional about having fun. Make time for the things you enjoy. Your soul needs that. You may also want to think about your physical health as part of your way of life. Now, I'm not going down the route here of saying your body is a temple, so you have to have a great diet and exercise so that it's a fitting home for God, because that is not what Paul was talking about when he said the body is a temple. But still, our bodies are gifts from God, and we do want to consider our responsibility to look after them. And while I certainly wouldn't say that our physical health is as important as our spiritual health, they're linked. Because the better you feel physically, the better you're likely to feel spiritually and emotionally. Exercise releases endorphins that make you feel better. And so, as we're looking at improving our emotional and spiritual health, it would be crazy if we didn't at least stop and consider our physical health as part of that process. And the final area I want to look at is service. Because without this, your way of life could just become too focused on your own needs. As we said many times before in OCF, we're blessed to be a blessing. We take time to do all of these things I've mentioned, to look after ourselves, to become healthier emotionally, because we want that to lead to wanting the same for others. You know, the closer I get to God, the more I want that for others. That means both wanting other Christians to come closer to God and wanting non-Christians to discover Jesus. And so I serve in my church, and I partner with my church in serving my community. Also, I serve my bosses and my students by working in my job as though I'm serving the Lord. And I consider such service to just be part of my normal way of life, who I am, who I want to be. So as a group, our corporate way of life then, and we're going to look at this soon, is just going to be a description of how things are done around here. Sometimes hear just different groups saying, this is our way of life. It's just what we do. It's all it describes. And serving others is a big part of what we do around here. And it makes us stand out. There's not a lot of people that do devote their lives to serving others. And the more we do it, the more we're going to stand out. I said before, St. Benedict wrote his rule of life because he was so unhappy with the immoral lives of those around him. And he knew Christians needed to stand out and be different. Now, I'm not the kind of person who says this modern age is the most immoral time ever, like some Christians do, because I think it's a bit of a rose-tinted view of the past, that. But just as in any age, Christians need to stand out and be different. And to do that, we need to be living intentionally. I went shopping yesterday evening, and I had to reverse into this parking space. And there were two cars in the spaces either side. So I used those two cars to kind of measure where I should be parking. And I got it in parallel with both cars, exactly the same amount of space between each car, perfect parking. Then when I came back to the car, I noticed I hadn't parked straight within the lines. I was still within the lines, but the car was at about a 15-degree angle to the lines. It looked terrible. I parked perfectly between the two cars, because they were both at about a 15-degree angle to the lines. So all three cars were just there, out of line together. So easy to be in the wrong place when you're judging where you should be on what the rest of the world is doing. The guide I should have been using to park my car was the white lines on the ground, not the two cars either side of me. And you might say, well, it's just easier to line up with the other cars. You know, it makes it easy for everyone to get in and out. And maybe in that case it's true. But in life, when we make our decisions based on how fitting in with other people, we end up not being lined up with Jesus. And that's why we need this way of life. Because our way of living needs to line up with Jesus, not the world. And the world needs our lives to line up with Jesus so they can see him revealed in the church. This world has seen too many Christians who talk about love, talk about how Jesus changed their life, and yet their lives don't seem to match up with it. And I don't want to be another Christian like that. That's why I've done this course 3 times now. That's why, and after the first time I did it, I came up with my own way of life. I've been trying to work on it since. That's why as leaders, we're looking at doing this with the whole church and coming up with a corporate way of life for OCF. John Ortberg once felt he was really struggling with his spiritual life. He's a preacher in America, if you don't know. And so we asked this guy who was his mentor, Dallas Willard, what would he recommend for him to do to fix it? And Dallas Willard paused for a while and then replied, "You must ruthlessly eliminate hurry from your life. For hurry is the great enemy of the spiritual life in our world today." John Ortberg says his response was something along the lines of a rather impatient, "Okay, I've written that down. What's the next thing?" I've heard him tell that story a few times. I'm never sure how much I actually believe that he said that. But when he tells that story, he also quotes Carl Jung, who once said, "Hurry is not of the devil. Hurry is the devil." See, as we reach the end of this course, we all need to think about how we're living and what we can apply from the course to start living the lives we were created to live. And that means slowing down, giving up the hurry the world seems to cling to, making time for the daily office, for Sabbath, for prayer, for reading our Bibles. See, this is one of, if not the most, countercultural thing you could do in our society. And our society desperately needs the church to be doing it. We need to show the church show the world that there is another way. This way of peace, this way of rest, this way of joy, this way of life. So if the musicians can come up, we're just going to take communion now. So this is not a thing to be, okay, just entered into lightly, a way of life. This is about seriously examining what we're doing day by day, moment by moment, and reorienting our life to what is most important to God. If we just maybe think and focus on that as we come to the table together. Thanks.